Good afternoon and welcome to Home Run with Helmed and White. As usual, thank you for tuning in as usual. And this is your usual drive time show with your usual duo. That's Helmed and Dwight, as always, here until the hour of six. Now, let's start with one of my favorite story from coming out of the world of geopolitics, which shows like a insane level of planning, if you ask me. In 2003, during the invasion of Iraq and the toppling of Saddam Hussein, what happened was that Iran and Iraq are neighbors. One thing that the Iranian learned from that is that if you have a centralized, centralized military structure in your country, when the leader is killed, everything goes crumbling down. It, you know, brings about the cascading domino type of effects where when you push one and it leans on the other, it basically causes everything to fall. It's like playing a giant Jenga if you played basically any type of Jenga game. Now in 2005, the Iranians came up with a somewhat, at least to me, a whole new military doctrine. They called it something called a mosaic military doctrine. Now, what they did in 2005 was they decided to split up their militaries in basically, I think, about 30 to 31 different divisions. And picture Namibia with all the 14 regions, and each and every single region has, you know, has the its own Ministry of Defense headquarter. That's how we must picture it. And it, you know, all these 30 to 31 basically military divisions, they all have their own generals and basically a whole like state level military command structure. And they all have, you know, each region has its own, or more like each region, or this just basically Namibian example, has its own military division and general headquarters. They have everything. They have their own ammunition, you know, supply. They have their own everything that you basically find in a country, you know, in a country's military. So they're not answerable to anyone, not even the president. But they, you know, the guy that runs the show, that has the off switch, is the supreme leader. Now, there's just one problem. As we speak, the whereabouts of the supreme leader in Iran is not actually, you know, very, at least last time I checked, the whereabouts are still debatable. Some are saying, you know, maybe he was injured in a, you know, in a strike, and now he's fighting for his life somewhere in a coma. But what that created is that it took away the guy that has the power to call for a ceasefire. In other words, if the supreme leader is out of the question, the discussion of a ceasefire becomes a very tricky one, because he's the only one that can negotiate it. When he's out of the picture, the 31 guys were given one very simple instruction. Unless this guy says stop, you guys, all you have to do is bomb the heck out of anything. Now, that basically brings about that whole discussion of, man, that's one heck of a planning. That's one heck of a planning. So, well, just look at the dates here. Invasion of Iraq and the toppling of Saddam, 2003. Fast forward, 2003, 2004, 2005, Iran puts, brings up this mosaic, military doctrine, that where they basically split their military in a way that if you can take over one, you know, even if you manage to take out one general, you'll still be left, you know, with 30 plus that you will have to deal with. No one wants to invade a country like that, because, well, it's not like, it happened in, Venezuela, for example. Take out the president, the whole thing crumbles. Except Iran is a bit different. Now, that way of planning, and I want to bring your attention to, you know, to just how sophisticated the structure is in terms of difficulty of overthrowing and basically taking over the government. If you topple, you know, the president with a centralized, you know, in a country where with a centralized power structure, you know, of course, you know, every country has a compartmentalized power structure, but when things are too central, which is basically a system that's followed by a lot of countries. Now, it creates a lot of problems that basically brought about the show or, you know, the TV show that you can find on Netflix called Designated Survivor. That is basically a place and, it's the best geopolitical. Actually, it's more of a documentary-ish. It has a few debatable parts here and there. Now, why I'm pointing at that is because today we're going to talk about, Africa's dependency again, for the millionth time on the extractive industry. And why does this part always coming up? It's because it's very difficult to talk about Africa's development or Africa's economic growth without coming back to that primary source, because it's the primary source of revenue for a lot of countries across the African continent, if not all of them. Now, so that means, anything happens to the extractive industry, we cooked. Now, today's discussion, though, on the other hand, is tries to look at can Africa basically asks a question that I think it's just say if you can just put it out there to be more of rhetorical. Yeah, can Africa innovate using technology? You know, using the rapid growth in technology. Can Africa innovate its way out of its dependency on the extractive industry? This is your mining and drilling, basically. Everything mining and drilling. And I throw fishing in there because, well, we have fish rod here. Mozambique had their tuna bond scandal, basically, like fish rod, but the Mozambique version, even bigger. When, boy, that was huge. We have just a couple of $100 million missing here. In Mozambique, oh, they're billions. Yeah. I think that's 1.3 billion. That's taking corruption to a whole another level. Then South Africa came in with their obvious, like, what? The whole country's fishing sector? You lost 1 point something billion? Yeah, step aside. Because we have corruption here in South Africa. We stole money from one hospital. How much was it? 2 point something billion. What is wrong with South Africa? Seriously, you guys match. Okay, wow. No wonder your officials have so much money. It's kind of difficult to bank, so just, put it in the sofa. Anyway, and when you put it in a sofa, Namibian, domestic workers finds it, we bring it here at home and create employment. We're not neighbors by accident. Come on, guys. Now, Africa's economic growth has mostly been driven by, among other things, the increase in land use, capital, and labor, but not much of, growth in Africa's economy has been observed genuinely in terms of productivity outside of the extractive industry. And it's very difficult to describe what's happening in Africa's extractive industry as, it's kind of difficult to categorize it under productivity because, we are not producing it in a way that we should. Now, that statement of Africa's economic growth has mostly been driven by, among other things, the increase in land use, capital and labor, but the growth has been observed on genuine gains in productivity. Now, this is according to the Economic Report on Africa 2026. The 2026 report. Now, the report is centered around the very same question of can Africa employ technology to basically build their own production capacity in terms of build up ways to produce something, not just be, consumers maximus. That's just the word I made up. Consumer and maximus. Common Latin name back in the when Latin was reigning, now it's a dead language, where we get the word maximum, consumers maximus. That's what we are. We don't produce, our biggest problem is we don't consume much of the things we produce, and we don't produce much of the things we consume. Let me put it this way. Most of the stuff that we produce, and most of it is coming out of the extractive industry. And you can factor in agriculture in that when you are talking about things like cocoa, for example. Because, well, Ghana and Ivory Coast, as we all know at this point, supplies over 60% of the global chocolate industry. If anything happens to Ghana, and Ivory Coast in terms of instability, and it ruins the agriculture sector, you will see the price of chocolate going through the roof. Good luck being romantic. Now, so Africa's dependency on the extractive sector seems to be, something that's been pointed out over and over and over again as to, as one of those things that's standing in between Africa's economic growth in terms of the visible potential, especially when you look at it in the, in terms of the resources, not just the natural resources that's underground, but also the youthful human resources that the continent is known for. So the continent has two main resources that basically makes the best recipe for significant economic growth. Actually, make it three. You have, slowly, as sluggish, there is a significant technological advancement. But that's like the third one. But number one, you have the natural resources underground. Africa is awash with that. And you have Africa's youthful population is the human resources, which is also, being shipped out of the continent. Which is why we talk about things like, things like brain drain. So, we have two resources that we could be using to advance Africa's economy, but we are not using them. Not the manpower, aka or human resources, not the extractive industry resources. Not the underground resources. Question is, but you know what's my favorite part? We have things like Vision 2030, Agenda 2063. How the heck are you planning on getting there? By, borrowing? By shipping all the resources in their unprocessed form? Good luck with that. So, why am I saying this is not the first time this is being pointed out? For several reasons. Reason number one, because it's, this is not the first time. According to one of my, favorite online library or information hub, that's Taylor and Francis, in April of 2020, Macky Sall, who was, chairing the African Union at the time, the president of Senegal called and also a former African, chair and a former president of the, of Senegal. He called for, in April of 2020, Macky Sall, the then president of Senegal, called for a new global order asking for the cancellation of Africa's debts in the context of the current pandemic. This is in 2020. Now, his argument was based on the lucid assessment of the extractive nature of the productive structure in the on the continent. Some African countries, African countries started, a lot of African countries, especially those ones that you find in the western parts of Africa, started acquiring the, getting their independence in the 1960s. That's why there's this very famous comparison in terms of economic growth between, either Ghana and South Korea or Nigeria and South Korea. Because these countries got their independence in somewhat around the same time period. They got their independence both in the 1960s. And, South Korea is at an economic level, that is basically falls under the category of developed countries. And, Ghana and Nigeria still fall under the category of developing countries. Which brings up the discussion of everyone would ask what happened, especially considering the natural resources underground of pretty much any African country, not just Ghana and Nigeria. And South Korea does not have anywhere near that level of natural resources. So that brings us back to Ntombi's song. Money is not a problem. A problem is not, is how to use it. Now, if you are listening to that song, just replace the word money with the natural resources. And then we can just use that whole song as a national anthem, or more like continental anthem for the entire African, for the entire African continent, to basically say, well, there are a lot of countries around the world that don't have the resources that a lot of African countries have underground, but they have reached into, you know, the level of economic growth that a lot of African countries, including us, can only dream of. Now, I don't live in a bubble, believe me. I know how predatory a country has to be to reach the level of economic, you know, economic development. I know that for the most part, when we talk about developed countries, we just talk about it in terms of look at what they have built. Pick a history book, find out how they managed to build that, and you'll know. Let's take Switzerland, for example. There's a very long history of basically their financial sector keeping money for some of the most questionable characters on the planet. For a very long time, Swiss financial institutions were shrouded in mystery, which made it, you know, which made it a breeding ground of, or money storage ground for a lot of questionable characters, from human traffickers, drug dealers, you name it, the ugliest of the ugliest of planet Earth. They kept their financial, you know, they hid their money in basically Swiss financial institutions. Well, we can't afford that. Oh, don't get me wrong, we'd make a lot of money, but the question is, we can't afford that. We basically can't. You know, again, this is just me explaining that I don't live in a bubble. I know very well what you have to do as a country to reach some degree of economic growth. Just take it as an example, you know, just take it as a source of income of you here in Namibia, and your homies that are driving, you know, license plate, you know, custom license plate Range Rovers. Look at what they do and what you do. Just look at it from that angle. What do they do? No, maybe he's just a lawyer or he's just a CEO. Are you sure? That's my question. Are you sure he doesn't have a side hustle you don't know about? Because you can imagine people that were comparing themselves to Kate Matlala in South Africa before the whole Makhandla Commission thought, they thought he was just a tenderpreneur. No, he wasn't. It turns out, he was. The whole time he was stealing billions of dollars with his homies, of course. They are now called like the Big Five. The point is, I'm mindful of the fact that a lot of developed countries had to do a lot of questionable things. The British were not even going to go there. Americans and basically the much of the Western world. Oh, we're not going to go there because that discussion spills over into colonialism and then looting. Now, I'm not saying we have to go that, which is why when it comes to economic advancement, I don't like to using the Western countries as an example on how to build an economy. I like to use China. Why? Well, because if when you're talking about the Americans, the British, and Canada, and pretty much any country that's in the western part of developed countries, if you want to talk about their development, you'll have to talk about a lot of looting in terms of how they acquire that wealth. But China, you can only talk about technological advancement, which means it just falls within today's in line with today's report. Can we use technology to innovate ourselves out of the extractive sector's dependency in terms of economic growth? Unfortunately,
it's a yes and no, Helmut. You know it.
A capital no and a small, very tiny font yes.
Do you know why I say yes?
Why?
You remember when you and I did the UN Conference of Trade and Development, when they gave that report about what Namibia can diversify its economy on, mm-hmm. based upon the extractive sector, we just build from the extractive sector, like in a direct line from mm-hmm. it, and produce products in line with it,
yeah.
which obviously shows you value addition.
Yeah.
The concern from being shown something like that is, oh, wow, we just take that one report
uh-huh.
and we can do everything. However, yes, Amut, yes. It's a good thing that you're slightly chuckling there. The however is the particular song and dance that we've also been singing since yesterday's State of the Nation. Because you highlighted procurement, I highlighted the local authorities. I discovered today that there's a piece of legislation that I didn't hear much about. I had an inkling, a slight suspicion that it is there somewhere, but I never knew its name. And we really have to understand the impact of, firstly, legislation on our economy.
Mm-hmm.
For example, something as basic, Hamoud, because we're obviously talking about innovating our ways, innovating ourselves to the desired levels we want as Africa.
Yeah, economic-wise, yeah.
Yeah. But it's not just about data. Look, one thing that was missing yesterday that I deliberately, which I did highlight, but I'm going to ignore it for today's discussion, is, for example, the president gave labor updates or labor statistics in like fragmented scenarios through her speech.
Mm.
Now, that fragmentation immediately will tell any person, okay, why is the labor statistics all over the place? So you ignore it. However, we need updated statistics of the labor sector, like what they do in South Africa.
Yeah, listed with all over the place.
The all over the place
part. Yeah.
Okay. So you would have, just before we walked in here now,
yeah.
My discussion with David just now was a scenario of, you know, look at the scenario of reporting on labor. The president basically reported yesterday. Her report to the country was basically a scenario of big picture things happening.
Mm-hmm.
Not the how does it impact your life, Helmut? What does it do? Did it change the statistic that you suffer from being unemployed to being employed?
Mm-hmm.
Or that you have the opportunity to build a business from something being installed there to assist you with something doing or leading to some sort of benefit being developed or accrued or being derived?
Yeah.
Now, the big picture reporting, meaning the fragmented reporting on labor, which is the most important thing, is because we have to ask the question about the messaging between NDB6 and the SONA of yesterday. NDB6, Hamoud, is literally about positioning the economy for us Namibians. I'll say it again. If you read SONA, if you read NDB6, NDB6 sounds wonderful and it says we've got to achieve more positivity, more positive outcomes, you know? Like the discussion that we had on Tuesday about the gaming, about the lotteries board discussion. The section that is quoted from NDB6 that I used in the script on Tuesday was, they cited a major growth. There was like massive growth between 2023 and 2024. And then they used that statistic, Hamoud, because it went something from, it jumped literally from something like 3 million to 21 million or 24 million that the gaming and gambling industry had developed. Now, I also realized that the person that wrote that sentence confused actual computer gaming, which is escapism that you and I interact with,
yeah,
with gambling. They confused the act of the leisurely act that you and I, well, I haven't engaged in it recently for the past 6 or 7 months.
7 months?
I told you yesterday was my graphics card.
Yeah.
Decided to
say goodbye.
Unceremoniously but silently announce its departure last year in October. And I sat there going like, what's this black screen in front of me?
No, I think I would need I would need therapy.
So yeah, my withdrawal syndrome has been extensive. But the scenario of that is the one dimension of gaming is escapism. Mm-hmm. It's like going to the movies. It's like going to a restaurant. You know, Helmut,
you have your kitchen. You could have cooked, but you just decided,
exactly,
you know what?
You've got that extra amount of money. Yeah. You want to go sit outside and you want to eat out at a different location. You know you can make the food at home.
Change your scenery, change your environment. I don't want to cook for today. I want someone to cook. Just bring it to me and, you know, give exactly. me that awesome treat.
Exactly. Now, there's a difference between being a consumer at home and a consumer at someone's
eating establishment.
Establishment where you're paying for it.
Yeah.
And you're paying in both scenarios. Now, the discussion that we saw yesterday basically almost spoke nothing about overall job growth. From the first paragraph that the president mentioned, and look, I'm going to give the president the benefit of the doubt in her reporting yesterday, because her immediate concern, if you think about politics, Helmut, obviously, is that she was now obviously going to respond to questions that the other politicians from the opposition parties had for her.
Yeah.
That is not the platform where you and I or the ordinary Namibian will ask her those questions. So what the president showed yesterday was, this is the report card of the big picture developments that we've been conducting.
Basically a summary.
Yes. Now these big picture developments, Helmut, you have to now give the things time for them to start showing whether or not the thing is producing, whether it's working, whether it has its impact, or whether it's actually doing something. So, on the question of innovation, in line with our talk for today, because our talk today is based on a UNAU approach, is that we are doing things ourselves as Namibia to try and solve, like, fundamental issues. So, the president gave her report card yesterday of trying to patch where the fundamental issues were a bother, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we need to move on from SONA. You get into this question once again of, can we innovate ourselves into the desired framework?
Yeah.
Now, here is a lovely position, Helmut. It's a very lovely position. So, the theme from this report that you and I are basing our discussion off is titled the Growth Through Innovation. Why I said it's a yes and no, and I know I'm taking you all the way to Korekas and bringing you back now to Kietmanshoop, is that there's a lovely point, not even in chapter one, but it follows just after the key messages, like Africa's expected growth in the medium term, key recommendations that show strengthening governance for frontier technologies.
Yeah.
Namibia has a big issue with that. Remember I cited, was it 17 bills yesterday? What was my count? 17, yeah, 17. 17 bills.
Yeah, that are pending.
Yeah, in the pipeline. Of those 17 bills now, we've got data protection and cybersecurity in there. Now, this report, in the cover it's got on it, the cover image it uses, is a robotics, giving you a robotics illustration of the new technologies coming about, you know, and the dependence on data and AI and all those fancy terminologies. However, here's the first fundamental question. Do you have the legislation to govern or regulate what you want to innovate with? Because, Helmut, if you have a basic regulation for a technology like a car that is 150 years old now, if you've got a regulation on a car that says, if you are the driver of the car, you must be able-bodied and must not have any other endorsements, meaning your eyesight should not be so bad that you cannot see. You can drive with the spectacles that you and I wear.
Unfortunately, yes.
You must be able-bodied to be able to reach all mechanical functions of the car, mm-hmm. which includes even the radio, the aircon, and the, what's the thing's name? The hazard light button, and you get issued.
I was going to with the pedals, but go on.
No, you need the pedals. Yeah. You need the other functions around the steering wheel and the gearbox and the stick shift. But you also need to reach the hazards button, which is a little triangle on your dashboard. Now,
you know, I was thinking about the pedals.
What?
It's because of someone that drove past us yesterday on our way home. And I was struggling to see
today. Helmut.
What?
Helmut, don't make this a gender thing. Don't make this a gender thing.
I didn't say it's a gender. You're bringing up the gender.
Because women know when we were making jokes of them. Because primarily it's...
That was a struggle.
And you know that most of the best drivers I've known are all women.
Yeah.
Most of the best drivers I've known, they would have never been in an accident.
Yeah, they are.
Because they would.
Where the reckless one? Just take any guy.
No, any guy. Awesome. Any guy below 25.
Give them a powerful engine. You have a catastrophe on your
Helmut,
hands.
Helmut, any guy below 25.
Not above.
The guys above, they've let go of those wild antics.
They know the cost.
Any guys below 25 who don't have jobs. And their parents just, here's the car, you know, you can drive it.
Yeah.
Then you see the homeboy is making donuts in front of the club for no reason. And I've known such guys. I even knew a guy that he learned to drive very early when we moved here to Windhoek.
Yeah.
Homeboy was stealing his mom's car out of the yard. He would put the car in neutral, roll it out of the yard, or, you know, lower the handbrake, roll it out of the yard. Close the gate, get in the car there. The downside is, as teenage boys, we think we are clever and we think we can be ninjas, meaning act silently.
Some of you guys, how African are your parents? Because mine, I stole Karimora and woke up in a coma. I can't imagine a car.
those are the city guys. Please don't talk about us guys that came from the rural areas.
Don't play with the rural areas.
You know,
Africa is still present
there. There you even have the girls and the ladies would know how to box you. So just you know, it's the city guy, it's the city people. So
it must be, yeah.
So when you look at basic regulations around technology, for me who's been driving a car now for almost 20 years, yeah. Let me not lie, let's make it 17. Yeah. That was a part of illegal driving and then legal driving. That's why I warned you, Ahmed.
Oh, come on. Look.
There's a part of illegal driving and there's a part of legal driving.
Look, there must obviously be some kind of a statute of limitation. No one is going to come here and start asking.
Let's be honest. Like the one guy said that I used to work with, he said, so there were 7 years of illegal driving like me. I said, yeah, you're right. There were 7 years. So yeah. So when you look at that time frame, for you to drive a car, you must have a license.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a license and you can still drive the car, someone with a license needs to sit next to you. Those are the basic regulations that exist out there.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with technology, which also has a safety concern. Now, it's the same thinking you can apply to things like cybersecurity, data protection.
Yeah.
We don't have those legislation yet. We don't have the legislation yet. I mean, when we did the discussion on the cybersecurity legislation, which is the draft, the IT people were talking about, but we need to be clear on what is, what's the thing's name? On authorization protocols and stuff like that. Because we teach students how to hack. Yes, they have to teach students how to hack.
Yeah.
Because the students need to know how to defend a hack.
Yeah.
If people have ever seen what a hackathon looks like, there's an attacking team and there's a defending team.
Yeah.
It's probably the worst soccer you would have seen in your life, Hamilton. But that's literally what the dimension of cybersecurity is all about. You need to test, defend, and then do the same. You need to attack and test the cyber defenses.
Yeah, you're basically like employing all kind of attack mechanisms that could be used with someone with nefarious intentions behind.
Exactly.
And just in case you find yourself into the system, then you try to figure out, okay, how did I get in? And then you try to patch all those things up to make sure that you don't have any leakage.
Yeah.
Because if you can find a way in, so are the attackers. Which I think it's a very awesome line of work to do. One tool that I've been introduced to, Kali.
Mm.
Yeah. This one guy, explained that, okay, look, as much as I like to actually recommend to people to start using, Linux-based operating systems, which has like a whole list of distros.
Mm.
So you can use Kali, and it comes with about 200 tools that you can basically use. That's used by expert security, cybersecurity experts to test the networks, penetrations. So just don't go around using it on your neighbor's Wi-Fi. Because some of the things you'll be doing using these tools are actually illegal.
Yeah.
In countries where they have the laws. And
but
now I'm throwing us under the bus.
You know, just throw us Namibia. Just throw us
somewhere. Yeah, like I think the whole the whole idea behind innovating ourselves to our desired economic position as a continent, that will that will bring up a lot of a lot of questions. When I started, I basically laid on the foundation of like two bigger problems that I see here. We have two main resources that basically makes up for a very good starting point for us to build our economic our economic progress to the level of a developing country. We could just have a whole region, the whole African continent could be basically be made up of developed countries. We have two main resources to basically pull that off, which is the youthful population that makes up for very good human resources, and the extractive industry, the extractive resources underground. Except we are very terrible at applying both resources in a way that either directly or indirectly they both find themselves out of the continent. Now, yeah. Young people are out of the continent, and we're looking, that's where the whole brain drain discussion comes in. And
that's also not measured.
Of course.
Because even South Africa makes estimates about its actual, its actual migration trends and what the reasons behind these migration trends are.
Yeah.
So there is, yes, a lot of economic migrants.
Yeah.
But no one in Africa measures this impact, because you just see someone flying out, someone flying back in after 7 years.
Look, from what I see, the very same way that we have rural to urban migration in each individual country, it's the same thing that we are seeing. Okay, people move from rural to urban because, in search of opportunities. It's the same reason why they leave the continent. It's all in search of opportunities.
Yeah. No, it definitely is there, Hamoud. And we now have a discussion also where in the extent to which development partners play a role in the innovation.
Yeah.
So when we look at the innovation discussion, remember when you and I did the power to X discussion last week?
Green hydrogen.
Yeah, green hydrogen. We didn't know as Africans that you can produce almost all kinds of synthetic fuels out of water. Out of water. Let me say it again, guys. You can produce all kinds of synthetic products. And it seems that the lazy technological developments and the lazy industrialization was based upon the oil and gas sectors. Because it's very easy to have a petrochemical sector. You set up the refineries, you set up the processing plants, you can make plastics, you can make all kinds of other particular everyday consumable products, products that are used in everyday scenarios. For example, I see all the plastic here in our studio. Imagine that a lot of these things come from a dinosaur that lived 100 million years ago.
Poor dinosaur.
But you know what? You improved our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the discussion, Hamoud. The question of innovation is, does Namibia go down the same path, go and run around throughout the whole country, collect all kinds of geological information and data, goes and reviews all maps and stuff, then decides to slam holes in everything that looks like a rock, a hill, a mountain, and even the seabed within our national waters, just to generate benefit the lazy way out of natural resources? Or does a country like Namibia really go and say, okay, listen, let's take our most promising science students at UNAM and at NUST and IUM, let's put them in there as well, and we tell them, go and get trained. You come back with that training and we position you at the universities where you are just researching and developing. Because the universities are supposed to lead innovation. Now, if you come and tell someone, how do we innovate in town planning? I would say, oh my goodness, I don't know. Why don't you go build a pavement? It's not rocket science.
Mm.
Look, Helmut, it's straightforward stuff. Now we get into other things like ordinary development. Do you like walking in mud after you just came out of the shower, you dressed up nicely, you're on your way to work, but outside your house in Nkurunguru, no, let me not lie, Nkurunguru's people will show up here and beat me up. Okay, let's pick another place. Let's say outside your house in, which other place has got gravel road that I've been to? But let's just imagine the setting. It recently rained. There's mud and water, standing water in the road outside your house. And now since you've washed, you've showered, your clothes are clean, do you want to be walking in that mess out there?
No.
On your way to work? And the next car that drives past you will definitely
splash some.
Will definitely give you the worst splash of your life, which will immediately turn you around and head you back home. Do you want to live in such conditions? No. No one wants to live in such conditions. So, the question still exists. Why don't a lot of these local authorities lay forward budgets that say, you know what? We see a whole bunch of shacks over there, but they've got gravel road. Let's go and formalize them, and let's just, you just throw down a tar road with a pavement, with a storm drain. And then you could then the actual councillors goes out to their constituencies and those, where those shanty towns and those shack induced areas are, and they go talk to the inhabitants and they tell them, hey, listen, guys, we are going to do this particular project. Since you already have a shack here, we need to know who is an actual Windhoek inhabitant and who's an economic migrant moving to Windhoek. We have to start doing surveys to start knowing if we're going to spend money, the money has to reach and has to solve a need, Helmut. Now, Helmut, that is immediate innovation. People need to come and ask themselves, how does a city like Berlin in Germany not have shacks? I'm not talking about the drug users, the junkies that live on the pavements or on the city, within the periphery of Germany's cities. I'm asking a basic question of why do they have low cost housing and then they've got the other spectrum of housing? You mean housing for people that cannot afford the ordinary prices in the affluent areas of the city? Then they've got housing for middle income, or let's call it middle class people.
Yeah.
And then they've got housing for the upper echelons of society. Why is it only when you come to Africa, you've got to see
informal
settlements? Why is it Africa and South America that sits, and Southeast Asia that sits with these issues?
I think that's because we are, first of all, that shows a poor planning.
Definitely.
That's very clear.
And we've got those planners instead of Windhoek.
There are a lot of...
They've got degrees, ne?
That's right. Look, the thing is,
We should stop giving each other fault here, Alma. We already said it. But no, truly, they sit there. They're there. They can see the issues.
Now, look, the reason why I'm saying, the reason why I'm attributing or pointing all the fingers to poor planning as one of the contributing factor is because there are a lot of alternative materials that you can use for building. And we just decided, out of the million ways to build houses, we decided to settle for one, which is obviously, as it's been indicated, not everyone can afford it.
Yeah, Hamoud, but you know what's the biggest issue?
What's that?
We're not supplying the market. If you go to South Africa, Hamoud, do you know that a house that you would consider $1 million Namibian dollars in Namibia, a house that has 1,000 square meters. Okay, let's just take this property where Eagle FM is based. This property. This property in Cape Town, you would get it for 300,000 with a house like this.
So your point is Namibia is more expensive?
For no reason. Because we are not supplying the market.
So the lack of supply has created unnecessary demand, jacking up the prices.
Yes. Meaning, what is our innovation based upon?
It's based on we have got to stick to bricks and mortar, which not everyone can afford. But don't worry, each and every year we'll be talking about we have a housing problem. No, we don't have a housing problem. We have planning problem.
Or every election cycle.
Oh, no, I will combat affordable housing and mass housing.
And then how does it happen? Do you know what's the biggest issue, Ahmed? We don't have to compete with Europe and the US on, and even with China on trying to build data centers. Because those guys have their own issues. They don't have to worry about us. But why are we trying to talk about AI, data centers, new technologies, but we can't even solve a basic shelter? And I know Maslow's hierarchy of needs has been debunked so many times already. But if you sort out the basic needs, we sort out the other concerns. So what do we have to do to innovate? Okay, Helmut, do you need 1,000 square meters to live in? No.
Mm-mm.
You don't. What do you need? Half of the space? Maybe? Do you have a car? I don't know. But Helmut, you don't need 1,000 square meters to live on. There is a flawed principle happening in the planning.
Yeah. Definitely, you know, a planning issue, especially now, when I look at it, the conclusion of a planning issue, you will reach it very easily when you start to look at it. There are a lot of alternative materials out there that would make, that will basically fast track the building.
Or even construction methods.
Yeah, there are a lot of, also, not just, you're right, not just the material, but also construction methods.
Mm.
And for some reason, we just decided to sort of like be boneheaded to the brick and mortar. Like, you know what, this is what we had. Look, I understand the longevity associated with, associated with brick and mortar. But the thing is, you are now going to have people that will be, knocking at the, 60 retirement at time, doorsteps, and they can't afford a house.
Yeah. Namibia is already there. I'll be honest with you. Namibia
already
is
there.
It's already there.
Yeah.
Especially in Windhoek and at the coast. Namibia is already. How much they're selling the worst designed homes in Swakopne for 5 million. The worst. How much the house doesn't even have view of the sea. Ne. And it's not like the Atlantic Ocean smells like roses and peach.
No, it doesn't.
It actually stinks as an ocean. But they're selling a house in Swakop for 5 million, Almut.
Okay, what led to the housing market to reach those levels?
It's all the tourist attention that we're getting.
So we are back to foreign currency.
Exactly. Which is, and Namibia is not even a buyer's market. Namibia is a seller's market. A seller's market is a seller can dictate any term, any price to you, Helmut, depending on what they perceive the conditions are. Now, let me ask you this other question, Helmut. This same ERF with these two structures that I highlighted to you here, where Eagle FM is based.
And now, about how many square meters?
This is 1,000.
Square meters.
1,000-something square meters. Plus, each of these spaces, the studio and
the front office.
The front office, you can add on is probably another 800. No, not 800. Let me not lie. Not 800. Let's make it up another 700 square meters. So, in actual reality, the living space, the moving space, the operating space for a human on this piece of land is 1,800 square meters. Né? You go to South Africa in a nice middle income or middle-class neighborhood in South Africa, you will get the same property for under 500,000 Namibian dollars. If you go to South Africa, you will see what a $5 million house looks like.
Isn't a place like Cape Town one of the most places where properties are going through the roof in terms of prices because of, primarily because of the same reasons again. You have a bunch of guys that are coming with a lot of money, and they're just buying up properties like fat cakes. And that demand is a very general business principle. When there's a lot of buying taking place, that jacks up the price, overpricing a significant part of, the list of potential buyers who are most likely more in need of that service or that product than the guy who's just coming from, from Europe, and they have properties all around the world.
Helmut, they've got enough in supply in South Africa. Namibia doesn't have that. For some reason. Do you know what I heard even last week?
Yeah.
I was busy helping my brother move. So I had to act, I had to be like the cheap labor. Here on the other side of Windhoek, Avis, on the way to the airport, nah. The city council decided to sell in bulk to property developers. In bulk at a price that is this low. And guess what? Now you have to buy an unserviced piece of earth, nah, for $1 million that has all the volcanic rock based in it. You're literally, in Afrikaans, we say you're building in the Hopsa, meaning you're literally building in the mountains, because it's not an ideal place to build anything in. That's not how
housing goes. Unless you're a millionaire.
Unless you're the millionaire. But you know what? There are literally Namibians doing that. They're building houses in that part of Avis, in that part of Auersplek, on the other side of Olympia, the other side of Kleine Cooper, which is on the other side of that mall. Because you obviously have to look at where consumers are based. Where consumers are based, you position services and other things. Now, let me ask you again, Helmut. Do you think we need AI now, or do we need proper
later
town planning, proper service provision, proper investment in basic services, so that the other things can work and function, but the other things are not needed right now? Look, an IT guy in there, an IT guy is not important right now, because Namibia's access to the internet, that availability scenario is like below 50%. That statistic is must be below 50%. If you look at that statistic alone, Helmut, you'll ask yourself the question, okay, so what's the benefit of building another data center besides the Paratus data center here outside Windhoek on the way to Okahania?
Yeah.
Anyone will tell you, well, unless you get a major subsidization in costs to build a thing, but you won't get it because potentially that other data center is not at its fullest potential in operation. It's not.
Okay. Here's the thing. You did say property developers, right?
Yeah.
Are those public or private?
Private, definitely.
Exactly. Now, the thing is, there's one very simple business principle we always leave out every time that we are working, you know, every time that we are working with the private sector. The private sector, it's a business. And like every business, the priority is profit.
Yeah. The priority is not they geared towards...
It's not let's house as much people as possible.
Yeah.
No, who has the money to buy so we can make money as much as possible? And this is not just the mentality of business people in Namibia. This is the mentality of every private entity the world over.
Yeah.
In terms of how they run their business, the people they owe the most duty of care are their shareholders.
Of course.
And unfortunately, that's the case.
Yeah.
So if you just, every time that you take something, especially that is meant to serve a large number of the public sector, of the general public, if you just, if you put it in private hands, you have to understand what you're getting into, that the private sector, it's all about generating revenue.
Mm.
It's because when you can only run a business if you're generating revenue. If you can't generate revenue, you're going to be put out of business.
Mm.
It's simple as 1 + 1. You don't have to be an economist. So when you take, when you take something like, take for example, a large part of the housing market and put it in the private hands, those guys are like, okay, thank you very much. We're just, we are looking for, who is buying?
Yeah.
Not who doesn't have a house.
Yeah.
Nope. Who has the power to buy? And then the usual business influence now comes in. The more people buy, the more the price are going to go up because of that demand. So when you bring in, look, I think that's one of those, who is this? Not hedge fund managers.
But the supply and demand, Hamoud, is also not led by data in Namibia. The supply and demand.
We don't know how much supply and what's the difference between supply and demand.
So far,
in housing.
So far, not even.
Or just all across the board.
So far, not even Sankwasa. Remember in his addresses to the new councillors, the one that you and I watched.
In Rundu, yeah.
Yeah, at the start of this year. Not even Sankwasa used that 300,000 housing backlog number in that speech.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because the number has definitely grown.
Definitely.
So, the last time we spoke about affordable housing and discussions like that, when we had Kanjengo here in the studio with us, that was 2024's election discussion, remember. The 300,000 housing backlog is a number from 2018. So, pre-COVID, post-COVID, we still don't know what the situation is. Now I ask you another scenario. Okay. Yes, the mass housing program is still ongoing. Yes, the Shack Dwellers Federation is doing its thing on its side. But for some reason, the Sankwasa's ministry counts what NHE is doing and what Shack Dwellers Federation is doing as together. However, Shack Dwellers Helmut is a community, as a private community initiative. Let me say it again. It's a private community initiative. Meaning, they just had one ideology. This is not about buying and selling properties. This is about making sure that, let's say, Dwight had a piece of land, but he's got a shack there. Dwight's economic opportunities are scant, meaning it's few and far. Dwight doesn't have a consistent income, meaning my job is not reliably paying me the same income. But however, I can at least still scratch a few $10 here, $100 there, you know, in order to save and pay towards my allotment, my specific, my property development. And that's where Shack Dwellers people come in, the federation. But as you can see, Helmut, they are a quasi-building society. An actual building society is something that is an active economic participant. Now, NHE builds for government. NHE doesn't build for the private economy. Mm-hmm. NHE builds for government. So that means who gets first dibs? Government employees to NHE houses, right? Mm-hmm. Shack Dwellers Federation builds and assists for community members who volunteer to join them. So if you don't join any of the two, or you're not part of any of the two clusters, You're cooked. You're in the private sector. You've got to deal with the private economy.
Yeah. And the prices in that sector
are just, they are
through the roof.
They're literally an Agatha Christie murder mystery novel, you know, because you'll try and wrap your head around, is this the petrol price inflation? What contributed to this?
How did we get here?
And you know what's the worst part? The property developers now didn't add any value yet. That's just the empty land, the virgin land standing there.
Yeah.
Then you're paying $1 million already. In Avis, you're paying $1 million, Helmut, for bush and rock next to a tarred road. Bush and rock. You don't even know if City of Windu can get a water pipe or an electricity cable through that rock. You're paying for virgin land $1 million Namibian dollars. Virgin land. So now, ask yourself the question from this now. Okay, so what is innovation going to look like for us? Because our discussion is based upon innovation.
Yeah.
What is innovation going to look like? Okay, so Helmut, first things first, we've got to update what is our housing backlog. That's number one. Second scenario is, for example, what kind of skills are we producing? Because we've got to know where this economy of Namibia is going to, you know? How many kids are passing school? How many kids are signing up to priority fields?
Like the STEM fields.
Like the STEM fields, which is most according to NCRST's CEO, Madam Peters or Professor Peters. She likes using the word STEAM. She uses the acronym STEAM, but everyone continuously uses the acronym STEM.
STEM, yeah.
STEAM includes the arts. And we really have to also understand what research and development will mean for this Namibian economy. Because in many cases, Helmut, our biggest problem is that we look for the easy commercial activities. What is easy? Either you go back into agriculture, you forget that you went to university, you forget that you learned something else, or you participate in some of the sort of like, what do they call that? I don't want to use that word, but let me use. It's like cordoned off sectors. Cordoned off sectors are, you go study accounting to go work in the financial sector.
You go study medicine to become a doctor or a nurse. You go study law and you go work in one of the law firms, or you work at, or you work for government.
Yeah.
You go study, what's the other one that's also a sure bet? You go study engineering and you get either into the private sector's engineering and construction activities, or you go join one of the mining companies. You go study, what's the other one also? You go study, what's the other sure bet job?
Teaching?
Not even teaching is sure bet, Hamoud. Not even teaching, my guy. In all honesty, Hamoud, not even teaching is, even though MESAC is, you remember when we did the discussion about the teaching bill,
mm-hmm.
which is also one of the 17 bills that the president mentioned yesterday. We are just assuming she's talking about that. She also included that bill. And I'm also assuming that she's talking about data protection and cybersecurity in that broad number that she highlighted.
Yeah.
But out of all of those particular scenarios, Namibia has got very little pathway for research and development on these surefire waterproof occupations in this country. Hamoud, where can you expand with research and development on law in Namibia? Unless you literally sever ties between Namibia, the law, the legal system that Namibia developed with South Africa. And I don't know how difficult that will be, but it seems it will be a monumental philosophical task, because you'll have to identify, are you throwing away some of the foundations of Namibia's lawmaking to make laws that just potentially might have human rights implications?
Well, it's either that, or it will end up looking exactly like,
like a circus, probably.
Yeah. Not just that, it will end up looking similar to what you are trying to change from. Because the question is, what are you going to change from?
Because this law has a function here.
And also there has been a lot of adoptions, because if we can say South African, but South African, or like generally, It's English common law, and you have your Roman Dutch law.
Mm.
These are like the primary ingredients for a lot of countries with Western influence in terms of how their justice system or legal systems operate.
Mm.
And, this is something that's coming from the Romans and then came through, went to the Dutch, and we're talking 530 AD.
Yeah.
So it's coming from there, and it went to the Dutch. From the Dutch, obviously, now the South African comes in, and you have all this influence coming in, and also the English presence also brings in also their way of doing things.
Mm.
So the South Africans, it's adopted it. The English adopted it. The Dutch adopted it. So it's one of those things of.
And in between there somewhere, there's even Greek influences in there somewhere, ancient Greek influences. So do you see the confusion? Meaning, what innovation has Africa done, for example, on something as basic as laws?
Nah.
We don't even have...
customary law is almost somewhat secondary to the foreign adopted one.
Yeah, but here's the thing. What's the issue with customary law? All the ethnicities have their own way of interpreting how a man and a woman and society is structured, right?
Yeah.
So now...
you can't make it one size fits all for a whole country, let alone a continent. You're going to end up with a lot of squabbles.
Exactly. Now, we face such issues specifically, and that's just from the humanities.
Yeah.
That's not even from a scientific part. Yeah, it comes from a philosophic part, because the philosophers and the scientists, they almost look like, peas in the same pod. However, the scientists used research, they used instruments, they used methods, they used chemicals, they used sometimes fellow humans. But yeah, they reached goals.
Unit 731.
They reached goals, and they championed various benefits that we now enjoy today. From the humanities side of thing, you've got art, you've got the law, you've got the way of telling stories, you've got the way of highlighting heroes and villains from your community, and so on and so forth. But we've not even done the innovations, for example, like in the creative sector even.
Yeah.
Okay. if someone shows up and says, but yeah, South Africa has been doing it, the Zambians have been doing it, Zimbabweans have been doing it, Nigeria has been doing it, Ghana has been doing it. Yeah, but look at the technologies that they relied on to do this. They relied on a Netflix. They relied on a DSTV. They relied on, and much of these technologies don't come from Africa.
Yeah, ruining my field of study here now that you pointed out all the, you know, like, look, you know, if, when you look at like the major cases, like one of the, you know, they're called like, you know, the most important case.
Yeah.
Like they're called landmark cases.
Yeah.
The most important or one of the most important, if not the most important case in a company law in terms of determining, take, for example, like, you know, the whole personality thing. Take, for example, if I own Eagle FM and, you know, I screw up. Sorry, boss. Just an example. Not, I'm not planning a coup.
That's Helmut, boss. just
not planning a coup. Now, the thing is, if I'm running Eagle FM, the question is, if one of the people that's working for me screws up out there, does that person come and sue me in my personal capacity, or do they sue Eagle FM as a, because Eagle FM legally is an entity on its own?
Yeah.
Now, the case that laid the foundation of that whole legal that basically enforced sort of like that legal personality, because the legal personality already, you know, existed before that.
Mm.
That as soon as you register a company, especially a limited liability one, then it exists as an entity on its own. Mm. Now, you can sue it. It has its own rights. It can conduct its own business and stuff. The case that basically laid the foundation and very important in, you know, if I was to be sued because of my company, Eagle FM, screwed up something.
Yeah.
The case that you are definitely going to hear the judge talking about is Solomon versus A. Solomon. That case is from 1897 England. And there's also one, I think, from the 18 or 1930s, one about, you know, company's duty of care. If you are, you know, if you're an organization, you owe your customers a duty of care, for example. Make sure that your products are as, you know, they are as good for consumption as possible.
Mm.
So you are legally required, if you are an eating establishment, for example, to meet certain standards or for whatever it is that you are serving, whether it's medicinal or just food or beverages.
Mm.
So that case also, I think it's from 1930-something.
It's a good thing you mentioned that.
Now, look, most of the landmark cases are coming from the British, the 18 and, you know, early 1900s all the way to the 1800s.
Which that speaks from the first industrial revolution.
Copy and paste. We just like, you know what?
And we don't understand what the implications of those developments in the legal sphere.
And we do that while wearing blonde wigs. I don't know who came up with that, but by the way, did you know that horse tail hair?
Yes, I would. I did.
Yeah, the most educated guy on the planet has a horse tail hair on it. But anyway, you were saying.
Okay, it's a good thing you mentioned that, because when I did commercial law at NAS.
Yeah.
Under patent and latent defects, when you sell, because South Africans are almost the ones that came up with the commercial contractual term known as food stewards,
yeah.
Selling as is, selling the product as is,
yeah.
especially if the product is secondhand or has been used before. And this can be anything from immovable to movable properties. So there was a lovely case cited in then was one of the discussions about patent and latent defects that you've got to identify. They're literally different sections that we were taught under. And one of them was about a shopkeeper, Hamut, that sold tinned food. The case that was cited.
Yeah.
The case literally was 1921 or something like that. In South Africa, I was even like, why are they citing a South African case? Do you know what's the most interesting thing about that?
Yeah.
It's actually case law that has generated a standard for why you have that best before tag printed on all products you buy in the shop, the expiry date. Now the South Africans have improved it by saying manufacturing date and best before date. So you see MNF, manufacturing date, and BB is best before.
Yeah.
So what happened there was that the case law was that the customer bought a tin of tomato baked beans in tomato sauce, because tinning and canning is a very old technology in manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
The customer bought a can of baked beans, got sick at home because the baked beans technically had gone off
while standing for very long on the shelf. The customer became sick at home.
Yeah.
The customer came back, complained to the store owner. The store owner was trying to say, hey, listen, plausible deniability. I'm not a manufacturer of the beans. You've got to go talk to the manufacturer.
That's where the technicalities now come
in. And
then
the customer took the storekeeper to court and said, hey, listen, this guy caused me discomfort and inconvenience because I became sick, very sick. I had to go to hospital. And the court ruled in favor of the customer saying, listen, if you are a shop owner, just because you didn't manufacture the thing
doesn't mean
you're not responsible, because you still accepted money from the customer. You were supposed to know. You were supposed to develop a field of expertise and responsibility in that expertise on knowing when this product is best for consumption and not. Once again, Helmut, what are we innovating from? If we have got such tenets where we don't know about the future dangers and issues that the 4IR, which we don't know where it is right now.
Oh, yeah. Where's Klaus Schwab, by the way? I haven't seen that.
And the AI guys, but Klaus Schwab is also facing all kinds of dodgy court cases. Have you not heard?
I mean, it's a Klaus Schwab.
I don't want to mention it right now, but things are looking dodgy in his landscape.
I'm just saying. Look, man, the guy's name is Schwab. But look, before, you know, Germans come for me. I think it was their head and the CEO of the World Economic Forum that also had to resign a couple of weeks ago because of, you know, Epstein file implications.
Of course. Yeah. I say of course because I don't know how far this guy's impact has been.
You know, one thing I don't understand about that whole thing. Mm. Guys, you have money. There are a lot of adults all across the country. Why kids? Just why? That's why, if, you know, when I rise to power, the punishment to that will be castration before the court, before prosecution, castration will start from you.
Let's make sure you have 8 wives, Hamoud.
8 wives? 8 wives?
Yeah.
You're saying 8 wives. I'm hearing.
I just gave a number.
All I'm saying is I'm hearing 8 headaches.
that's exactly why I said. Before, when you reach that level, just make sure you've got the 8 wives.
One. I'm just going to go with one. That's enough. You know,
you've got to be like some of the Nigerian heroes that I see some of the guys applaud on social media. Like, well, what was the guy with the 6 or 7 wives in Nigeria? The one guy? He's like a very well-known.
Do you have any idea how many kids you're going to have after 2 years?
Do you know what's the headache? Who's inheriting what from you?
Oh, yeah, there's that.
Yeah. So.
That's perpetual poverty you're inviting.
On the one side, yes.
On the other side?
On the other side, you obviously have to make sure you're probably, you know, involved in so many beneficiation agreements.
Exactly. But look, you know, when it comes to this whole, okay, look, if you're going to have at least, you know, more than one wife, you know, having them in close proximity so they know each other, I think that's, you know, that's a good thing. I totally understand why our, you know, forefathers did that. And some of our, you know, people in today's world that are stuck in forefather mentality. Now, the thing is, like 5 wives.
What
really?
Are you doing?
Now,
forefather mentality.
So, because if you just, I feel like if you just run around having kids that you have not introduced to each other, one day they're gonna show up at your doorstep, and now you will have to explain, son, I can't put it in words, but can we talk in private? Yeah, you know that hot smoking girl you've been telling me about that you just brought? Yeah, she's your sister. Now, knowing the 21st century, my generation way of doing things, at this point, they are there to tell you not because we want to get married, because she's pregnant. Now, how are you going to navigate that?
Yeah, there are such realities.
Yeah.
On a more positive note, innovation really is key, Hamoud.
Not that innovation, technological one.
Yeah, not innovation in how to build a society from your own bloodline.
Uh-huh. And oh no, by the way, there's, you know, we have learned now from the Spanish that that's a bad idea, terrible idea. Now, in this report, there's a part for page 120. You know, they're just looking at Namibia, and they looked at one interesting point of Namibia, green hydrogen.
Oh, they cited our green hydrogen.
Yep. Namibia aims to export hydrogen products, including ammonia, methanol, synthetic kerosene, and hot. First time I read that, I went, almost went like, is it briskets? Maybe I was a little hungry at the time. Now, look, Namibia.
You're thinking about rusks now.
I know. No, look, the thing is, Namibia has a lot, at least according to the, what's pointed out in this report in terms of Namibia's industrialization direction or innovation, the use of technology to innovate our way out of the reliance and dependency in the extractive sector,
yeah.
Which this one basically low key falls into.
Yeah.
And, is that there are a lot of byproducts, there are a lot of connected sectors that will be linked to the green hydrogen initiative that has a lot of market potential out there that could help or more like contribute to Namibia's innovation. The green hydrogen program is part of a green industrialization initiative characterized by an integrated and multi-sectoral approach.
Actually, this is the power to X. This is power to X that they're talking about.
Just the list alone, they're from kerosene, synthetic
ammonia.
Ammonia, methanol, back to power to X.
This is power to X that they're talking about. And that is the thing, Hamoud. We can do it, but who's helping us? This is not knowledge we came up with. This is not R&D we came up with. But if I tell you now, Hamoud, that South Africa has had the company Sasol for 50 years. Why was Sasol started? Sasol began because of the oil crisis of 1979 and of 1980-something. Mm-hmm. There were two oil crises that were caused by Iran. In retaliation to guess who. So, Sasol was started. Sasol their expertise is in synthetic fuel.
Yeah.
Now, we sit with South Africa right next door to us. And that's the reason why we've got leaders on this continent in innovation. What are we doing? Okay, we're talking to Germany, we're talking to the EU.
Yeah.
But the South Africans had the ideas.
There's one interesting paragraph here on page 120.
Mm.
It brings in the discussion of robbing Peter to pay Paul that we are playing off of. Between the different energy sectors, on which one are we going to prioritize? In terms of, are we going with oil and gas, or are we going with green hydrogen in line with the the 2015 Paris Agreement's energy transition discussion and stuff?
It's a good thing because I remember that was the question I asked to the former Minister of Mines and Energy. What's his name? Tom Alwindo. Why are we exploring for oil? Or why are we allowing the oil majors?
Well, energy mix.
If we said yes to green hydrogen, which is completely clean.
Energy mix.
Hamoud, we can't be like...
We
can't be like the Christians who still believe... Okay, let me not attack my fellow Christians. But you know what? I like picking fights.
Energy mix. Is a politically correct way of saying, dude, oil has a lot of money.
Yes, but until when?
Until
China is only willing to still use fossil fuels until 2060.
Well, until they stop.
India is only willing to use fossil fuels until 2050. What are we doing?
Well, we're getting ours. Ours. Yeah, right.
Still don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Petrofans people are trying to speak about first FID later this year as if it's a sure bet. Petrofans is part of NAMCOR anyway.
We are Christians. We've got to throw faith here. Cross your fingers and toss. Hope by 2035. Yeah. So, the green hydrogen program, according to the report, the green hydrogen program is part of a green industrialization initiative. Now, this that's common knowledge, characterized by an integrated and multi-sectoral approach that involves the power, industry, agriculture, and transport sectors, with participation from multiple ministries, including Ministry of Mines and Energy and Ministry of Industrialization and Trade.
Both of them don't exist anymore because both of them
have been.
Yeah, now because now you have Ministry of of International Relations and Trade.
Yeah, and Mines and Energy now has industries with it.
Now, the thing is, if you look at all the, ministries involved, according to this report, and let me call them byproducts of the green hydrogen initiative, like your kerosene and stuff, trade will have to be conducted. Obviously, will be conducted. Everything that you're producing, if you want to make money from it, you'll have to sell it.
Yeah.
So the market is obviously shifting now. If you seeing that most of the cars that are driven, I think second from the dominating Japanese brand are coming out of Europe, and now Europe with their CBAM, that's going to bring about a whole recalibration. We need a whole new paradigm of doing it, of interacting at least market-wise with the EU. So we'll sort of like have to, non-blinkingly watch the direction in terms of energy transition and the market requirements they will bring about. Because CBAM was just implemented this year.
Yeah.
Now we'll have to keep up with everything that we're selling them to show that, this is was made using environmentally friendly sources of energy, and fortunately for us, that environmentally friendly source of energy is being set up and being funded by them. What are we doing?
Exactly, Hamoud. Whose idea is it?
It's like they're helping us meet their market requirements. Basically, at this point, it's either they're helping us to meet their market requirements or they're helping themselves to meet their own market requirements.
Do you know what it feels like? Yeah. Let me be honest. Do you know what it feels like? Yeah. It feels like, someone that has too much money and they would like to spend on charity. But they know that they're going to get a tax refund from government because they can prove that they spent on charity or that they had a CSR. You know, that's how it feels, Hamoud. Now, the downside is, when you go read up, all these synthetic fuels are already being produced.
Yeah.
They just want to go in position where it can be mass produced at the biggest available level. Now, this is why I am so excited about it, because it doesn't damage the natural environment in Namibia,
yeah,
but it does create local benefits. So all I'm seeing is positive plus positive.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the Namibian government pursuing? An FID in oil. In oil.
Uh-huh.
And then if Deep Horizon happens there, 230 kilometers away from the Namibian coastline in national waters.
Okay, let me answer.
Who's going to respond, Hamoud?
Let me answer this the most political. First of all, insurance companies. second, that's an easy one. we are doing everything we can to make sure that we end up with a Deep Water Horizon disaster. And we have experts
to solve it for us.
Yeah, to solve it. Obviously we are not wishing for a Deep Horizon situation. The thing is, if we end up with a Deep Horizon, that's like 300 kilometers offshore. So,
what did Hopwood himself say? Who knows what happens out there on those high seas? 200 kilometers, Hamoud. Imagine you're 200 kilometers on land from Windhoek. 260, almost 300 kilometers from Windhoek is where? Otjiwarongo. Can you see from Windhoek where Otjiwarongo is? No. You can't see. So who knows what's going to happen out there in that sea? We're going to be dependent upon the information that comes through from who's operating that oil rig? The oil major.
I said, we have experts on the ground.
It's going to be another scenario of trust me, bro.
Yeah, I think I've listened to these guys a little too much, to the point where I think I can almost predict what the response to the question is going to be. I think that's the problem with being, with being confined in terms of how you respond to a question, because you are stuck in this whole confinement of trying to be politically correct. It's very easy to either avoid the question, partially answer it, or not answer it at all.
You know, even even baby oil wouldn't have saved.
That's on you.
A quick break.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Nikurane ngeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo toto ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kongerewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu batatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Can Africa navigate its way using technology to its own desired economic growth level? And this is on an African level. What's painful is the case of the reliance on extractive resources, which is leaving the continent somewhat in its raw form. It's not just a Namibian thing or a Botswana thing. It's basically the whole continent. Now, the economic outlook for North Africa here is an example. The economic outlook, the report, and I'm on page 4. The economic outlook for North Africa remains robust in near term, remains robust. I mean, it's doing very awesome, with real GDP growth projected to rise by an average of 4.4% in 2025 to 2026. This was before Iran, Israel, US conflict. So this math will have to be redone. Now, and then it goes on to say that, it's driven by increase in energy production in places like Algeria, rich natural resources, of course, and expanding extractive industries. Really?
Hamoud, it's sometimes also a scenario of where you can have the best impact. That just that point that you highlighted, where the focus is towards. So we were already told at the start of the year, Namibia can diversify from its extractive industries, but the diversification takes place on top of the extractive industries. Ne?
Yeah.
That UNCTAD report. But then, when you look at, remember when you were at page 120 with Namibia's green hydrogen?
Green hydrogen.
Just
yeah.
Below on page, what's this page's number? Oh my goodness, this page doesn't have a number on it. But anyway, just below that, they've got Madagascar and Rwanda as an example of aerial cable car transport in both countries. So these are countries that have a larger population than Namibia, but Namibia has a comparable size to Madagascar.
Landmass?
Landmass.
Yeah.
Namibia and Madagascar are comparable to each other. But Madagascar has got, what was the amount of people? I think like 40 million almost.
And
Rwanda is 5 million in that very small commas region sized situation.
Population?
Yeah.
Rwanda. No, I think Rwanda is more than that.
No, they were 14. Remember our report?
Yeah, they're about somewhere between, I think they're over 10 million.
Yeah, So they've got transport and mobility issues.
Yeah, no, but I think for Rwanda, when it comes to modes of transport like that, countries with a small landmass like Rwanda, it's much easier compared to countries with a giant landmass and a sparsely distributed population like Namibia.
Yeah, but Hamoud, remember what was the issues in Rwanda's discussion when that standing committee went there?
They don't have space for houses.
They had to sort out new planning, new urbanization routes, because their population is growing.
Yeah.
Right. Namibia has the space, but Namibia doesn't plan properly. We don't have a plan for how cars move. We don't have a plan for how people move. We don't have a plan for where people will live. We don't see plans, Hamoud. I'm really sorry. We don't see them.
That's a very good point. And you can see that on my best and favorite example. We have crossed fingers everything in Namibia. We have crossed finger farming. We have crossed finger bicycle lanes. If you look at the bicycle lanes, for example, there are parts where you'll find bicycle lanes, and on other parts, there are no bicycle lanes. Now, what am I supposed to do? Cross my fingers and hope I'm not run over?
Do you know what's the worst case scenario? So what they are doing in Madagascar and Rwanda, with the innovation they're bringing, the cable cars?
Yeah.
Yeah? Because they've got hills.
Okay, like as in trams?
No, a tram is on the road. A cable car.
Recently, suspended.
Yeah. Cable cars used for mobility across the city because their cities are built like this on hills. Yeah. Windhoek is also built like that.
Yeah.
But do you think someone in Ludwigsdorf wants to see a cable car station from their hill to Independence Avenue? No, they don't want help.
Yeah, and plus I think our hills, I've seen a bunch of those in places like, for example, parts of Brazil. And those places are mountainous. And if we can bring that here in Namibia, the question again is, how many people do you have? Yeah. And it brings up again a maintenance question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looking at the number of people that you have, how many people are going to be using that mode of transport in terms of Namibia? Because there are 3 million people in Namibia, but there are not 3 million people in Windhoek.
Yeah. Now, remember the conversation we had about actual functioning public transport.
Yeah.
We can innovate on that even.
I'd go with buses rather than...
I'd also go with buses because we don't have the budget to build an underground railway system.
No.
I'll tell you today, City of Windhoek probably will not put their neck on the line to borrow $100 billion to excavate land, build just an intercity exchange or a intra-city exchange, meaning between Havana to Kleine Cooper. They won't do that.
I think it would even be unnecessary because maybe we are going to get there with population growth, but we are not there yet.
But we're in the top 10 of the largest cities on the continent.
Really?
We're in the top 10, Helmut.
Uh-huh.
Just in size.
Yeah.
Size, not population size. Size of the city. Windhoek is in the top 10.
Have you seen Windhoek in December?
Hamoud, that's obviously when everyone evacuates.
Yeah, there are about 5 people in Windhoek at a time. So there are services that, taxi drivers struggle to find customers, let alone...
They even leave.
Tura boys, everyone leaves Windhoek.
So which shows you what? There's a large economic migrationary trend in Windhoek. Windhoek's issue is there's a lot of people. Windhoek has too many jobs that the rest of the country comes to try and do.
Yeah.
Now ask yourself the question.
They're not for permanent stay.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That label of permanent inhabitants is also a fluctuating thing because you can be someone that lives here, been born here, and then every December you go to the coast or you go to the north or you go to the south or to the east. Mm-hmm. You just get out of the city because you've seen of the city too much.
Yeah.
But then there's also a scenario of people who rent in Windhoek. And then every end of the year, they go and, relax back at home. It obviously depends on what the interpretation for relax is, because some of the people I know tell me that they're going to work some more, and I was like, what?
As a village, professional, it's kind of difficult to say, how to put this, going to the village is not a holiday.
Yeah.
Because that's plowing season. No one is going to sit there and say, you know what, is from Windhoek. Just put your Instagram. Here is the plow. Let's do this.
Yeah, show them how you're plowing on the Instagram.
That's when...
What's wrong, Em?
Your city boys.
And city girls.
Yeah, your city boys and city girls. You should see them, trying to,
find reception out in the bush.
Yep.
Yeah.
Plus, I mean, there was, like, wasps was my favorite part about, you know, about looking after cattle with city boys. Because they will go looking after cattle black, they'll come back, you know, with Asian facial features. Those wasps will do that to you.
Yep. But, yeah, so, our concern.
You asked a question earlier about AI. When you look at it from this perspective, primary needs on the continent, not just in Namibia, things like housing, you will just look at housing and, at AI and start going, yeah, maybe let's do that a little later. Let that be secondary. The primary, we haven't sorted out the primary yet.
Mm. No, we haven't. I don't even know if we've sorted out, basic needs facilitation. Basic needs being, you know, you tell the councillors or the local authorities across the country, go and assess what investment is needed there. Because we can innovate, Helmut, what we've already got. You know, if you look at the green schemes, you can innovate from the green schemes. You can innovate from our tourism. You can innovate from our own transport system. You can innovate. You can, you know, someone just has to motivate to a town council. Let me give you the best example of innovation I saw yesterday. I watched a documentary, a German documentary. A bunch of high school children innovated on money. Do you know what they did? They introduced a currency that you only find in the province of Bavaria in Germany. Bavaria is the province that houses the famous football team Bayern Munich.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that the place where your BMW is from?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can only use, because there are certain rules and legal requirements that they had to play with.
Yeah, I can imagine. There's money involved.
So this economics professor, he's the brainchild of the idea.
So we're talking about the currency here, right?
A currency.
Hey.
What he did was, he wanted to show practically the value of what money does to a community.
Mm-hmm.
And they experimented in this one small town in the province of Bavaria in Germany.
Yeah.
You only find this currency there. Guess how you get access to the currency, Helmut? You must register and you must drive a specific car for you must rent the car in euros. But you drive this car around, which accumulates like a point system. When you've accumulated it, you go and collect the currency and then you can only spend this currency in that province.
Hang on a second. You rent a car and then...
With euros.
With euros.
And by using the car, by driving around,
mm-hmm.
this car generates to you this particular currency. And then you go and collect this currency, which is in a safe in this economics professor's office.
Mm-hmm.
And you spend this currency. This man is not a multi-billionaire. He's not controlling anything.
But aren't they already paying for the rented car?
Yes, but you're paying it for euros.
Uh-huh.
So the car plays as a social project.
Okay.
There's a discussion I had here once on Eagle FM, Helmut, on when I still did the business and economic segment about how to pivot an economy to the society instead of an economy pivoted to a sector.
Yeah.
So if you pivot an economy to a society, you start looking at things at, you know, trying to understand like the green economy,
yeah.
trying to understand like why you need affordable housing, trying to understand why you need jobs for all able-bodied or all, working age people in your society. And this is a pure example of it. This particular example. This is how basic the innovation is, Helmut, which says, this guy tried to show an example to his students. He was teaching economics on a high school. Let me say it again. Just like I highlighted that shooting that took place in Austria, né, last year, that school shooting.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 10-year-old who was classified as a high school student. Do you see the advanced education levels already? Do you see the advanced teaching and advanced education levels already? Here I find out teachers in Namibia at public schools are doing amapiano. Showing off assets and all that kind of stuff from their weekend special moves that they learn.
Look,
is that educational?
Where were these guys when I was in high school? That was an called for.
But we've got to ask these. We've got to ask these basic questions, Hamoud.
Yeah.
If your economy is working for you as a Namibian, there are certain automatic benefits that have to be accrued. Now, how does an economics teacher and his high school learners from his classroom come up with a social experiment that generates a benefit for society? How does this happen?
A social experiment.
It's a social experiment because money is a social mechanism.
Yeah.
It can only be used by people to buy goods for people.
Within a certain jurisdiction.
Yeah. So how did they do this? Why don't we have such levels of innovation coming about? Remember the...
In other words, we're not very good at thinking outside the box.
I don't want to throw, you know, cold water onto people's wishes. But yeah, let me say yes, because I agree with that. Let me ask you this. That lovely life-size toy plane outside ECN. Né?
Oh, boy.
Don't laugh, HD. That life-size toy plane outside of ECN.
Uh-huh.
Né? It's a good thing that guy did.
Yeah.
However, no one actually came up to him and said, "Hey, my guy, let's help you with training. Let's take you to the next level."
Yeah, like
let's mature things for you. We don't want you to just live pies in the sky dreams just like that. Let's take you to the next level. Now, what was supposed to be the next level? This guy needs to be then taught how to do design, drawings, and then how ideas get channeled into an economic setup. But are we plane manufacturers in Namibia? No.
Forget plane.
So someone
are
who
we
has
plane
money...
parts manufacturer.
Helmut, how
do
you think Mitsubishi started in Japan?
Sorry, I raced it a little too far.
How do you think Rolls-Royce started? Mentioned it the other day.
Let's go with Omlemba and, you know,
underwear and toothpicks.
Yeah. Are we underwear or toothpicks manufacturer, let alone a plane parts?
So we're not even there yet.
Yeah, we're not there yet.
So, yes, it's a good thing green hydrogen is listed in this report that we're looking at. But we're not taking the examples further. We're not increasing, you know, I was taught in marketing, you've got a product range. Product range is about so many projects, of so many products, and so many variants of the products, meaning product depth, product width. You can't just sell me milk, Helmut. Mm-hmm. You should, if you're a milk company, you also have to sell me cheese. You also have to sell me cream cheese. You have to sell me yogurt. You have to sell me the variants of yogurt. You've got to sell me butter. You've got to sell me, what's that other one's name? That other dairy product. I think a creamer is made from milk. I think so.
Cream?
Like Cremora and Ellis Brown. I think they're made from milk.
Yeah, unless I've been lied to, Cremora is made out of milk.
Yeah, but it's powderized.
Yeah, powder, yeah.
Yeah, which is an industrial process. So you've got to sell me all those products. You can't just come and sell me regular, standard, old milk. Yeah, that's what the other company also sells. Now, ask yourself another question. So we had that life-size toy plane being constructed. That guy went through many effort. He was trying to be Leonardo da Vinci in... Was it post-COVID? When did he make the thing?
And I think that was way post-COVID.
That was post-COVID.
Yeah.
Literally just after COVID. But everyone was like, hey, thank you for the arts project, not thank you for the innovation project.
Now, look, what I can't seem to wrap my mind around with that is, why is it at ECN?
Ay, Helmut Hochmann.
It has nothing to do with voting, is what I'm saying. Look, I would understand if it was at the Ministry of Mines and Industries, because there's an industrialization component to it. Why ECN? That's like, I don't get that. But look, the thing is, the aviation industry is one of those industries with a lot of strict requirements for one to participate in. Mm-hmm. Now, for someone who has interest in that industry, if you want to, you know, if you see potential in them, you will have to, there's a lot of information that must be imparted on that individual. In the 1980s, there's McDonnell Douglas DC-10 plane, a three-engine, passenger airplane. They're the ones with one engine on both sides and one mid-engine like on the tail. Mid-air, that mid-engine that mid-engine, that engine in the middle blew up mid-air. Now, at the end of the, of the investigation, they found that the reason why it blew up is because of hydrogen impurities in the titanium that was used to make the engine. It blew up mid-air because of impurities. Mm. Now, when you look at it from that, you'll begin to understand just the strict requirements that comes with participating in the aviation industry to make parts, let alone build the whole thing from the ground up.
Mm.
Again, look, I'm not looking down on our, industrialization potential. I'm looking at how Peugeot kicked the bucket. And
they didn't kick the bucket. The plant kicked the bucket. You can't say Peugeot kicked the bucket.
Yeah, you're right. Peugeot is still operating. Yeah. The plant kicked the bucket.
Yeah.
And anyone that will basically, witness that thing from the beginning should have seen Peugeot stretching and saw that, let's move the bucket somewhere else. Because, like you pointed out, the market was already taken by South Africa. And we just decided, let's just cross our fingers and hope it works. And then it didn't work. But if you look at the, industrialization type of initiatives that we have, that we tried to implement, and some of them are, basically died a natural death. And now you have the two domain one, which have become somewhat of a, textbook example of our lack of somewhat like a planning in terms of, industrialization. You have your garment factory in Kurunguru and your immortal leather tunnel factory, in Ondangwa. And again, these two are sitting dormant for that, the fact that they're sitting dormant indicates to me that, again, we still have to put in more effort in planning. We need to put in more effort in planning.
Yeah.
Because clearly, if you are building something from the ground up and you find out that, okay, you have a well set up physical infrastructure, but it's not operating, the question you would naturally ask yourself is, where did I go wrong? And more often, now these two, you can throw a Peugeot in that bucket. What we didn't do is, what are we planning on making and who is going to buy it? We just, I think part of the reason is, we are giving too many speeches, and these speeches are full of what, Mr. Shobun calls expensive promises. And we are now trying to the best of our ability to implement the promises that we have. To implement the promises that we have made on political platforms. Until halfway through, that's when we realize, okay, we made promises, we made political promises, and then we made a political follow through without looking at how does the market look like. In other words, we have, crossed finger, project type of development.
Yeah.
Let's cross our fingers and hope Peugeot works. It didn't work. Let's cross our fingers and hope, Nkurunkuru garment factory works. He's still laying dormant. And the governor was actually talking about, watermelon juice. If you ask me,
I have a question.
So
it does work. Okay, you take your mic, HD. But this mic wasn't working, but yeah.
When 2026, right?
Yes.
We have so soon vision, vision 2030 is
3 years away. 4 years away.
Three, 4 years away. And I don't
Jesus.
Vision 2030 was created, when I was still a young youth. But I don't know.
Actually, how old are you?
I'm in the older part of the youth.
Wait. I was at the start of high school when.
When was Vision 2030 created?
It literally came before 2000.
Before 2000.
Yeah, it was.
Before? I thought it was after.
When's the actual date of this thing? Because I was still on at the start of high school of that thing when President Sam Nujoma mentioned it.
Okay. Regardless.
Yeah.
So I don't know what all Vision 2030 entails, but now when 2030 comes and maybe. Only 10, 15, however much the percentage is.
2004, okay. Yeah. I didn't want to frighten us that badly. Okay.
When Vision 2030 comes and not everything in Vision 2030 is achieved. What happens then?
Well, what I've seen is
thank you for starting with well.
A remix and repeat, but just label it differently. And I'm talking about Vision 2030 coincides with the SDGs, because the SDGs deadline is also 2030.
We also have a joint Vision 2030 with the EU. Yes, yeah. The African continent. And no, look, what I have, one thing I've seen is, are you familiar with the silencing of the guns by 2021?
No, what is that?
Yeah, it was an African Union project. They had that, you know what, we have to silence the guns by 2021. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're in 2026. And last time I checked, the Rapid Support Force is still causing chaos in Sudan. And, Donald Trump and the Qatari, or was it the UAE, have, you know, just tapping themselves on the shoulder after dragging Kagame and Tshisekedi to the UAE to basically sit down and sort out their M23 chaos.
Mm.
Yeah, so the thing is,
From 1989. The M23 chaos is from 1989. Yeah,
they've been exchanging greetings in terms of, using C4 for a while now.
Yeah.
And the thing is, every time that a plan is made, or more like a vision is made, and the mm-hmm. time comes, and the world obviously can see that not much have changed.
Yeah.
Like Dwight said, what you are most likely see is rebrand.
And repeat.
Yep.
They did that with the Millennium Goals, which was the precursor to SDGs. They just instantly repeated and realized, oh my goodness, no one is meeting the Millennium Goals, which was supposed to end by 2015. When we did that discussion in 2024, we realized how the SDGs came about.
Mm-hmm.
They had to start negotiating before they went and canceled the Millennium Development Goals. Yeah, MDGs. Yeah. They had to, before they canceled the MDGs.
Mm-hmm.
But before we continue, guys, I quickly have to do my live read and, honor our advertisers with this particular message. The Vita University, for the 2026 July applications that are now open for the Faculty of Health Sciences for the postgraduate diploma in Community Health Nursing Level 8. Admission requirements for candidates include that the candidates must have a recognized nursing qualification at NQF Level 7 or higher from a recognized higher learning institution. Candidates must also be registered as a nurse or midwife with the Nursing Council of Namibia or the Health Professionals Council of Namibia. The candidates must also have a minimum of 2 years working experience as a nurse or midwife in any health facility, and candidates must write a short essay describing the motivation for pursuing postgraduate diploma in community health nursing. Qualification duration is 1 year and the mode of delivery is full-time. For more information, please call 081-403-6406. Vita University, where everyone is an achiever. So, yeah. Helmut.
What happens is they basically change the name and push it forward. And from 2015, the SDGs now.
Yeah.
Yeah, taking it from...
Actually, 2013.
Wait, 2015. So it's around the same time as, the Paris Climate Agreements.
Paris Climate Agreement is 2012, 2010, because the Kyoto Protocol, the Kyoto Climate Deal is from the 90s.
Yeah. Now, just look at the where were the SDGs pushed to?
The SDGs?
Yeah. They are going to run until
2030. They're ending 2030 with Vision 2030.
So by 2030, all the SDGs are supposed to have been achieved.
Across the world by all 190 plus country member countries.
There is one thing I can tell you, not happening. The SDG report, was that of 2024, 2025, the one that Antonio Guterres said makes for?
Sober reading.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Where he realized that so many things post-COVID had literally stopped SDG implementation and...
Mm-hmm.
countries investing in the goals that they said yes to.
Mm-hmm.
So on the bigger scale of things, we also have to, as Namibia with the new administration, we also have to coordinate what have we achieved in relation to the SDGs.
And then if a particular country doesn't meet its goals, what happens to that country then?
Well, it ends up like Namibia is being helped by the EU and Germany. They come and they take your little hand as a developing country and they lead you through the development stage. I'm just summarizing it primarily because that is what's happening to us.
UN member state were bombing the heck out of each other from the Fed of until, January.
Until this weekend.
Yeah.
Until this weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah. When the ceasefire kicked in yesterday or the day before?
The ceasefire has a little bit of issues.
Many issues.
A lot of issues.
Yeah.
Because, Iran has a military strategy called the Mosaic military strategy.
Yeah, and Israel has its own military strategy known as the Greater Israel Strategy. So you've got competing interests in the Middle East.
Get so much more.
You get so much more with the ShopRite price because we buy in bulk and pass the savings on to you. Save on 2 kg crystal gold parboiled rice, only $29.99. 2.5 kg best choice pure white sugar, just $49.99. And 5 kg top score super maize meal for a low $62.99. Deals valid until 19 April 2026. Get so much more with the ShopRite price.
Welcome back. It's 6 o'clock on the dot. In terms of the SDGs, those also, you know, those things, those goals being achieved. No. Take goal number 16, for example, promote peaceful and inclusive societies for sustainable, inclusive, but it just takes, the whole goal out through the window because you have three different religions that are basically knocking the heck out of each other, you know, in the Middle East. Inclusive societies for sustainable development provide access to justice. Justice? Really? Justice.
Yeah.
Look, the International Court of Justice last year, throughout Sudan's case against the UAE on alleged genocide, not because Sudan didn't have enough evidence to back up their claims. Mm-hmm. It's because when the UAE signed up for the genocide, convention in the 1940s, they are part of a clause within the convention that basically exempts them from being prosecuted in the event of the fact that they are accused of genocide. Who in their right mind adds that to a convention? They somehow added it to it. The UAE decided to exempt themselves from being prosecuted. Now, when Sudan took the UAE to the International Court of Justice, mm-hmm. the UAE's main defense was like, this court doesn't have jurisdiction to prosecute us according to this clause. And they were right. Mm-hmm. Now, the justice part, again, out through the window, inclusive, out through, we are in 2026.
Yeah, loopholes everywhere. Loopholes everywhere in this world.
Yeah. So 2 minutes into what would be business and economic segment, but taking over is obviously HD with Business with Roy. Until tomorrow from me, same time, same place on your favorite radio station, Eagle FM. Stay tuned for the next program.